episode 109, Taps. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And this is Tony.
And we are the Backseat Producers.
And today we're covering Taps, a film starring Sammy Davis Jr. and Danny Kaye. Right?
I know.
Dance their way to happiness.
No, I'm not right about that. Who do we got?
Not right about that. In this one we've got...
Timothy Hutton.
Timothy Hutton, Sean Penn.
Tom Cruise. Rodney Cox. George C. Scott.
George C. Scott. Yep.
Breakthrough film for some.
Yeah, this was. At the time, these guys were. A number of them were just starting off their careers, and now you've got some pretty big careers going from. And
Timothy Hutton, ironically, I don't know if he fizzled out or what.
No, he's the lead actor on the TV show Leverage.
And it's a fantastic TV show, Leverage.
But well, what did he do between? I mean, that's a
made
show.
About 30 more films.
Yeah, he made a number of films.
Okay,
but
this was a big guy in Ordinary People, in this movie, and a lot of earlier movies. Everybody's
well, this was the about 11th feature film he was in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
and it was Sean Penn's first feature film, and it was Tom Cruise's first feature film.
Okay,
right after this movie, Sean Penn went on to do Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Right,
and. Tom Cruise went off to do Legend.
Right. Okay.
So this was the breakthrough for both of them.
Yeah. And it's a good movie as a breakthrough movie just because it's about a group of young men. So it was pretty easy to find. What I'll say is the casting director, whoever did the casting for this film, should have gotten some kind of award because this person saw talent. They really did, and people who have had long careers.
Well, Hutton was nominated for a Golden Globe for this film.
Really?
Yes.
Who was
Hutton?
Deservedly so, I would say. All right, let's go ahead and go around the table, high level overview, and for giggles, let's go ahead and put Anthony in the role of the guy who has not seen the movie.
Yeah, let's just pretend that I only watched the final 10 minutes.
Let's do
to
that.
Find out how it ends.
Let's do that.
I'm a Generation X person who, you know,
just
lives in a 24/7 news cycle. I can't watch a whole movie. You gotta, you know, go back and forth. You know,
yeah, read the Wikipedia and watch the last 5 minutes.
That's right. Exactly.
All right. So, Daryl, what did you think of the movie?
Great film. Even I remember seeing this back in the when it first came out. At the time, I wasn't terribly impressed with it. It was just wasn't my cup of tea. But it's a movie that aged well.
Yes.
I mean, you can still watch it even though it was made in 81. You don't really get this. You get a better sense of the time period they were in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a slow psychological drama that builds to a rather. Explosive conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a good movie to watch. I mean, you can get a lot out of it.
Yeah,
because
I remember seeing this movie in heavy rotation on cable. I did not. The movie came out in 81. I was 10 years old when it came out, so I didn't. This isn't the kind of movie I would have seen in the theater. But this was the kind of movie that was on HBO, and it was one of those ones that would have been. On HBO during the day, during the week, during the summer, it was on, you know, four times during the course of any one week.
Right.
HBO and would have seen
was,
it. Yeah, and would
HBO
have seen
was,
it.
Was in heavy rotation because he didn't have a lot of movies in
right.
the library yet.
Right. And so I would have seen this movie a number of times and remember seeing it a number of times. I remembered a good portion of the movie. having gone back and watched it just in the last week, I was surprised. I had forgotten some of the impetus for how everything happens, how the plot is driven through. But it came back to me pretty quickly once I started in on it. And I honestly, I had forgotten that Sean Penn was in it at all.
Yeah, I forgot that Tom Cruise was, this is his first movie.
Right, right.
I had a hard time recognizing him because he's only about in his early teens.
Yeah, he's not very old at all, and he's got a scowl on his face through most of the movie.
Yeah, he's completely different, a different person. He's a little chunkier.
And he's not the Tom Cruise character that he is in until a lot of his other movies.
Until the very end.
Yes, the last scene you see him in, it's like, oh yeah, that's Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
That is totally Tom Cruise.
That's the only scene I saw.
And yeah, I mean, you can totally see he's, you know, he's hamming it up, and that's, but appropriately so for what was going on at that.
And what his character was.
Right. And I will agree. I think it really stands up well. I was surprised at how well it did stand up. A lot of times I will have a movie on the list to suggest that we watch, and I'll watch it before I, you know, bring it to the group and say, yeah, let's go ahead and do this one. Knowing what the movie was about in general, even if the movie wasn't good, I thought the discussion about what the movie was about might be interesting.
Right.
But I think the movie itself really does stand up well.
Yeah, even the title itself is somewhat of a misleading nomer. We tend to think of Taps as a funerary song.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But Taps is actually blown at the end of the day to signify this is the end of the day.
Right, yeah.
And the story was it was the end of the day for this institution.
Right.
And they just didn't want it to happen.
Yes. So you And because I want to have as much discussion about the movie as kind of about thematically what the movie's about, I want to do like a really brief overview of the plot of the movie because it is a slow drama. If we just discuss the plot, we can get through the discussion of the plot in just a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. It's not a deep plot. It's character driven.
Right. This is a character driven story.
And there's a couple of really strong monologues, I think, that drive the character, the introduction of the characters, and the point that they're trying to drive home. Especially, I think there's a monologue at the beginning of the movie where Timothy Hutton's character is being put into a position. He's being given the position of basically head cadet.
Right.
The former head cadet. He's basically a graduating senior.
Mm-hmm.
For lack of a better way of putting it, he's graduating out of this institution. The tradition is the next final year student.
Well, there's a competition between the final year students, and he had won.
Yeah, he had won the competition. He has been invited to a dinner to basically be officially given the title and to kind of pass the torch between the last guy and this guy, the new guy. There's a really great monologue that George C. Scott gives in that kind of gives you an idea of what his MO is. His position as a former military leader who's now the head of this institution, and he really wants to instill his experience onto these boys.
Right. He's essentially preparing them for a career in the armed forces as officers. And what he put as leaders of men.
Yes, yeah. He always referred to them as leaders of men.
And he's kind of working in a difficult condition because this is an era we're only 6 years off the Vietnam era.
Right.
And the American military is still pretty much in the doldrums at this point. So we've got a lot of tension between the cadets and the townies.
Yes, a lot of tension. And one of the next big incidents in the film after Timothy Hutton's character moves into this position and he goes back to the barracks, the guys congratulate him. Shortly after that, they have a
commencement,
a commencement ball.
Mm-hmm.
And during the ball, as vehicles come up to bring the soldiers and their dates into the cadets and their dates into the ball, there's a group of townies who are sitting outside harassing them. making fun of the uniforms, making fun of them, just generally berating the military.
Usually and, just generally being asses, let's
right,
put it this way.
Right, which, it was not uncommon. It's not an uncommon occurrence. It was, it's less common now. At the time, I would say, it wasn't that obvious, it wasn't that upfront. But if you had a group of teenagers who probably got a hold of some beer and were being a bunch of dickhead teenagers, they might have done something like this. Yeah, and during this razzing, some of the cadets start talking back, and a fight breaks out. George C. Scott's character runs out to try to break up the fight. Somebody grabs gun.
The sidearm. He carried a ceremonial sidearm,
right,
as part of his dress uniform.
That he thought was unloaded. It was not. The gun was pulled and fired, and one of the townies was killed. A teenager mm-hmm. was killed. He was arrested, taken away. Before this, during part, was it
well,
part
yeah,
of the commencement?
Well, yeah, this bill is back step, just one
yeah.
couple things. After the Timothy Hutton character, who's is promoted.
Yeah.
The next day, they're having their big dress parade for the end of the year, and George C. Scott, the general, gets up and makes a speech. And at the end of the speech, he announces that the school is going to be closing.
Right.
It's been bought out from under them, and well, the board of directors has decided that it's worth more as condominiums than as a military academy.
Right.
And it's going to be closed, and this is their last year.
Yes.
And none of them saw this coming.
Right.
They're all just sitting there stunned.
And this was actually, I mean, I think this was another commentary on the society in the 80s. There was a couple of points of commentary, I think, and this is early 80s, the greed generation, the greed decade coming in, and you know the great military machine that we had through the 40s, 50s, 60s into the 70s is a dying artifact. It's a dinosaur, and these types of military academies that are
out of favor.
Yeah, it's out of favor. It's
declining enrollments, and they don't see any point in continuing.
Right.
There was a very big temptation to take these large tracts of land and basically just knock them down and throw up a bunch of condos.
Sure.
I mean, it's the land itself was more valuable than the institution it represented.
Yes.
Again, all of them have been drilled into this idea that they're part of this institution. It's their home. For the Timothy Hutton character, he's lived there since he was 12 years old.
Right.
So he's been there for almost, five, 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the only life he's ever known.
Right.
And he was, you know, this is his crowning moment. This is the point where I've worked for all my life to get to this point, and now the whole thing has been pulled out from under me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to get my year. Well, chances are I'm only going to get 1 year up at best. And now with the incident in the parking lot with the fight, the board of directors decide they're just going to close the school immediately.
Well, and the cadets only find this out by watching television. They
yeah.
get the news watching television.
Right. No one ever bothers to inform them.
Yeah. And that's when the movie it takes on the great role of this movie and the real driving point of the movie. And that's when the students take over the school.
Well, I should say that the students take over. It's when Moreland decides he's going to take the matters in his own hands. He's no longer going to be a passive observer. He's going to take all the principles that he's learned
right.
and have been put into him, and he's going to make a stand.
And yeah, he's been told that he is to be a leader of men. So mm-hmm. he's going to lead the men.
Yeah.
He's going to do what he feels is right, what he believes. The general thinks is right, and until he can speak to the general and get a direct command, he is performing an assumed order.
Well, yeah, his idea was it was supposed to last another year, and all of a sudden now they've moved it up. It's going to be closed in the next couple of weeks.
Right.
They don't have. I mean, everything's being pulled out from under him at this point.
And being militarily trained, he gets his orders from one person, his commanding officer.
Yes,
his commanding officer has been arrested, had a heart attack, and is now in the hospital. He can't get an order from his commanding officer. So he takes his last order in that is and that is that the school will remain open for another year. By God, he's going to do what he can to make sure that happens.
And this is the point where everything starts to escalate.
Yes.
Now was just one thing is the quote unquote adults in this film tend to marginalize the students. They just think of them as a bunch of kids running around playing army. They don't seem to have the same. They don't have any idea of just what this means to some of them.
I think they don't fully appreciate how well trained those kids were.
Right, they think they're just a bunch of kids.
Right,
but they're not.
Yeah, they're kids with toy guns playing at soldier.
Mm-hmm.
Those kids have been taught
with real guns, with
live ammo. Have been taught military strategy, military theory.
And they're disciplined too.
Yes, and they are, and they know how to follow orders.
And they will. Well, that's just it. That's one of the little kind of subplots.
Yes.
In here is the underlying thread of total loyalty and blind right. obedience.
Right, and that's framed really well by the three lead young actors.
Right.
Tom Cruise, Sean Penn, and Timothy Hutton. Timothy Hutton is he kind of represents following the orders blindly.
He's a true believer, is what yeah. he is. He believes he just doesn't believe it. He lives it.
Yes.
To him, it is just not a bunch of empty words.
Orders are the letter of the law. They're not to be misconstrued or to be
ignored at will.
Anyway. Well, and not even ignored at will or watered down. There's no room for interpretation. Yeah, it's the letter of the law, period. Where Tom Cruise's character is the gung-ho military guy.
He said, yeah, I'm all behind you because this is what I've trained for.
Yeah, I have trained
I don't
to
care
be
what
a
the
soldier.
Cost is.
If I'm going to be trained to shoot a gun, by God, I'm going to shoot a gun.
Right.
If I'm going to be trained to fight and die, then I will fight and I will die. And that is my
I will
job.
I will follow my commanding officer, right or wrongly.
Right.
And you have the Sean Penn character who is kind of in it, reluctantly in it, because this is his best friend, and best friends don't run out on other best friends.
But
in their
same
time of needs.
And at the same time, he's also the one willing to question.
Right.
He's the one willing to.
Well, he takes the role of essentially, I'm the rational voice here.
Right. Right. And he's used to question the action and mm-hmm. and to let Timothy Hutton explain why he's doing what he's doing. He's a little bit like, I mean, in terms of literary devices, he's kind of like Watson mm-hmm. to Holmes. The Holmes character needs Watson so that the audience can understand the thought process.
Well, he takes the role of narrator for the audience.
Yes.
The audience is asking these questions, so the character has to.
Yeah. Why?
To ask them
why
to.
Do you need to, you know, put up barricades in your rooms? Why do you need to mount guns from apartments? Why do you need to put 10, 12-year-olds on the front line with live weapons?
What are we fighting for?
Yeah. Why are we doing this? What purpose does this serve? And that's his role in the film.
So as our story progresses here, now they've taken over the academy. They've mm-hmm. barricaded it. They've stocked up on food and fuel and whatnot, so they're ready. But things start escalating faster and faster. First, the local police and the state police come in.
Yes.
And they find out, well, they're really outgunned here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
These kids are loaded for bear.
The local police come thinking, you know, we'll be able to flash our badge, flash our gun, and this will all be over in 5 minutes. And they realize very quickly
they're up against 110 people with M16s, mortars, and machine guns.
Yes,
they're not exactly your average everyday bar fight.
Exactly. Which is you kind of get the impression that this is a small town that this institution just happens to be in.
Mm-hmm.
That they are not in any way prepared for this. They bring in the parents of some of the students. Including Timothy Hutton's dad,
mm-hmm.
who is in the military.
Yes,
and you know he's there to represent a voice of reason,
or try to.
Yeah.
In the end, he just ends up making it worse.
Right, Right. They and eventually they do bring in. Did they say it was the National Guard?
Yes, they were gonna. They brought finally bring in the National Guard, and this is where our Rodney Cox character comes in. He's the CO of the National Guard contingent.
Right.
Now he's trying to defuse the situation because he's seen it's totally gotten out of hand. But he keeps laying down the heavy that you know the governor is seeing you as just a bunch of terrorists. They don't care what this is about. They just want this to end and end it any way they can. But he doesn't want to sit there and just charge a bunch of kids because he knows he's going to get a lot of people killed for no good reason. So he just lets them kind of stew in their juice for a little while.
And I think for me, his character was one of the most interesting because I think he represented to the audience what the military, what a rational man in the military really is like.
Right, he has a nice little monologue in there too.
Yeah, and his monologue is really great where he basically tells Timothy Hutton's character, you've been trained by someone who's kind of nuts. I think he said a death lover.
Well, he said you've made you into a death lover.
He made you into a death lover.
You've not seen what it's really all about. You've got a lot of theory stuffed in your little noggin, but you don't know what happens.
Right. And he even says something to the effect that I can see how much you love death, and I hope that you come to understand how not right that thinking is before you really see what it's about, before it's too late. And I thought that was great because having grown up in a military family, one of the things that bugs me sometimes is how the military can be portrayed in the media and in pop culture. And the character that George C. Scott portrays and this military academy is one side. There are people like that. There are people that, by God, they are like that. But like most of the people I know are like Ronnie Cox's character. You know, they don't. I mean,
they're career people. They've seen it all. Yeah,
it's a job, and it's the way their life is. But it's not how they want to be.
Right.
They don't want to go to war. They don't want to have to pick up a gun and stand on a line. They will do it. They will do their job well. They will fight to the end. They will lay down their life if they have to. But if it were up to them, they don't want to. It's not about that. That is not about that. That is not what their life is about.
And that's where the Timothy Hutton character comes in. He's fighting for a cause, rightly or wrongly. It's his cause.
Uh-huh.
And he can't see any other way around it. Even though as the negotiation goes on, he keeps giving back. First that he wanted, you know, the demands that they wanted an investigation as to why the place was sold so fast and why the general was arrested so quickly and a couple other things. But by the time end of the movie, he's just down to the point where you just let us talk to him.
Right, right.
Because the strain of the situation is starting to wear on him, too. He's trying to keep...
The fact is, he's still a 17-year-old kid. He's not a seasoned military professional with you know a decade
years
of
experience.
You know.
Yes, and he's trying to keep a lid. He's trying to keep his men from deserting, mm-hmm. which they're starting to slowly fall away from because they see that this thing is not going to end well. They're not. It's nice that the school's not going to close or it's going to be closed, but I'm not willing to really die for this place.
Right.
And he's also starting to suffer from the fact he's trying to keep, you know, Tom Cruise character in line. This guy is ready to run out there and take on the entire National Guard by himself.
Yes. And you get the sense that he's got a group of guys that are on his side and are like-minded to him.
The students...
It almost seems like that was a subplot that may have gotten lost somewhere along the way. Because I kind of got that feel earlier in the movie, but it kind of got lost at some point. Where it seemed like Tom Cruise's character and the guys in the berets. Mm-hmm. I mean, for lack of...
The Red Berets.
Yeah, the Red Berets. The Red Berets all kind of had that mentality. They were of the same like mind. And you kind of got that he was funneling the guys in that direction, and maybe the guys were picked to be the Red Berets because of that mentality. And you got the sense that it wasn't just if Tom Cruise's character went off and was a wild card and did this, he would be doing it alone. He probably had a good a good force behind him, a team that would have
who would followed him anywhere because he's the leader and they will follow him without question.
Right. One of the people in the chat room, Kate, we were talking about the military. Says the military is vilified yet revered depending on the perspective and the political climate. I think what's interesting about this movie is it does both, and it shows you both sides of the coin. You can have somebody who's gung-ho military and have it be too much in a time of peace when you're at home, when you're not tempered by a life, which I think is one of the interesting statements that this movie in the end does kind of make is these were kids who didn't really have a life. They didn't have any other life, any civilian life, any real life.
They had been there since they were children, and now they've grown up in this whole little bubble.
Right. They didn't have another life.
They didn't have any perspective on it.
Exactly.
I mean, they're told that essentially from the time they're there, you're special to this place.
Right.
And the outside world
doesn't understand us. Right.
So we're going to ignore them. We're going to live in our nice little bubble as long as possible, and we're going to have our own traditions and our own ceremonies and our own rewards and our own punishments. So again, it's going to be a better than the civilian world because you will be recognized for your accomplishments. You will be punished for your mistakes.
This is a meritocracy.
Yeah, this is a true meritocracy. There's no favoritism in here.
And we've got a set of rules, a structure.
They're all laid out for you, so you don't have to guess.
Yeah, there is no question. If you follow the rules, this is what will happen. These are your rewards. These are your punishments. There's no ambiguity to this. It's not like civilian life.
Yeah, one of the questions here, parallel to the Dirty Dozen for personalities. Well, no, not really.
No,
I don't think there's any parallels to this because it's not about the personalities of the individuals. It's the whole story centers around three individuals.
Yeah, yeah, it really does. Well, and then in the end, the fourth individual, the Ronnie Cox's character, and he really does give that outside perspective that you're not seeing from from the inside.
During the filming, Rodney Cox is always outside the gate.
Yes.
They're always talking through the gate. Uh-huh. So he's always on the outside world trying to come in. And they're trying to keep the students are trying to keep the outside world at bay.
That's an interesting symbolism that I did not pick up on. I did not pick up on that.
I think that is what Daryl's saying, is that the world is insulated, at least from the perspective of the kids, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've been kept that way. They have been kept insulated and isolated. You know, they are made to stand apart, look different. They have haircuts that make them stand out from the townies. The townies have that late 70s, early 80s, long, shaggy hair look that is very different from the guys
with
their crew cuts.
Well, they represent all the things that all the parts of society that they're trying to get away from.
Right.
The disorder, the chaos, the slovenliness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The lack of discipline. You know, they're the exact opposite of what these guys are.
Right. Right. So in the end, let's see, there's another question.
Well, they're, as I say, kept that way to prepare them for the roles. Well, the real world. Yes, they're being prepared for the elites of society.
Well, they're being prepared for the military, period.
Well, and also the elites of them, because these guys essentially go on to the military academies like West Point, Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, which are extremely difficult to get into, even under the best of conditions.
Well, I think the thrust of her question is more that they have a certain worldview that says that the townies are basically themselves insulated.
Right.
Exactly.
They do not understand.
They don't want to.
Both sides are living in their own world and pushing against the other.
Right.
And there is no attempt at understanding.
Right.
The townies think that you guys are freaks. You guys are fags for wearing your cute little dress up uniforms. You guys, you know, don't know what it's like out here in the real world. You know, you guys have, you know, your toy guns and your marching, but you don't know what it's like to live real life.
And play Atari.
Exactly. You guys don't have, you know, coin-operated machines.
Well, actually, there's kind of an allusion to that. Yeah, there's a lot. They sneak in a lot more stuff. There's one little great scene where Timothy Hutton goes into the room of the younger cadets and they've got a TV stuffed in a one of the footlockers.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as he comes in, they give the footlocker a kick, and the TV falls into it and turns itself off. And they're kind of like, real, and like, oh, God, you know, we've been busted. And like, he sort of ignores it because this is too good a day to screw something up like this.
Right, right.
And of course, as soon as he walks out of the room, there's this enormous tension just drains out of the air. It says, oh, man, we got through that.
Yeah, so. So I think the town is the people who live in the small town who are not
society. The town too. It's also the board of directors. I mean, they just don't even understand this place. They said, well, it's just, you know, it's just a quaint little school. It's not that important if we tear it down and throw away 114 years of tradition and just turn it into some ratty condos. Yeah, and we're gonna make
You get the sense that the board of directors have absolutely no concept of what's going on at the school. They look at it as probably as a revenue stream.
That's all.
And that's it. And that's the only thing they see it as. Mm-hmm. As long as people are paying to send their children there to get this type of education, they're happy. Well, enrollment is declining. Careers in the military are declining. This is not a valid career path anymore.
Plus, make a shit pot full of money by turning it into real estate.
I mean, if you look at the size of the facility, they had a fully functioning school, fully functioning dormitories. A parade grounds,
mm-hmm.
and God knows, knows whatever else they had. I mean, once you start extrapolating from there, just how big was this place?
Well, it probably covers several hundred acres of prime real estate.
Probably. And in some cases, probably, they might not have to tear down some of those facilities to convert them into condos, especially the dormitories.
Well, yeah, those are pretty solid-looking buildings that they've been there for 100 years.
Yeah, they seem like they were pretty nicely built and already,
ready for, just to go in and gut the interiors and remodel them for individual apartments.
Yeah, I can see their point. I can see the board of directors' point. One of the interesting things about this is one of the things that I liked about the film is all the motivations that they established for all the characters made sense.
Mm-hmm.
There was no characters that were completely out of place and thrown in there just to prove a point. All the characters had real world motivations and they all made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And
in their own way.
Yeah, unfortunately, most of the character motivation came from the children, and it was just how they were trained, how they were raised, in that lifestyle, in that school.
Yeah, and to roll on to our conclusion is, as things start to escalate more and more, the tensions gets to Timothy Hutton's character almost completely until the point where one of the cadets is set on fire while trying to start the generator, mm-hmm. because they cut off the water and cut off the electricity. So now they're down to scavenging water out of the heating system and trying to start the old generator. One of the cadets gets badly burned, and at that point it starts to dawn on him that, this is real. The people my guys are starting to get hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're starting to get fatigued by the whole thing. You can't stay at a total readiness level like that for long periods of time
he really starts listening to Ronnie Cox instead of just fighting him at every turn.
Right, and the final point comes when two of the younger cadets, who are a little more than 10-year-olds,
they're little kids,
the psychological warfare of having their parents drive by in the speaker truck every night begging them to go over the wall. One of them commented on it. She said, "Oh, they're not playing the speak." He said, "Those speakers are really, really annoying." The other one says, "Yeah, they are really effective." You can see one of them. He's starting to break down. He can't take it anymore. He's only reason he's staying is he doesn't want to see like a coward in his friend's eyes. And his buddy is, he's kind of on the edge, too, but he's still leaning back the other way, and his friend is just starting to come unglued.
Well, and you really get the sense that the one is coming unglued, and the other one has succumbed to the peer pressure.
Right.
And for these younger cadets, It doesn't seem that it's about the training and everything's been ingrained to them. It's
but they haven't been there.
They want to be. They want to be those guys. They right. look.
They
up
look
to
up
the
to
older
them.
Kids.
Right.
And they can't do something that would diminish them in the eyes of those other.
Right. They look at them as you know as parents and older brothers.
Right.
And it's hard for them to just you know to break.
Yes.
Break the ranks here. And but the one kid he's starting he it's really getting to him and finally it just gets too much. And he says, I just can't. He throws down his gun, which is kind of a mistake because it goes off. And he starts running for the gate.
Uh-huh.
And as he throws his M16 down, it goes off.
Right.
And it unfortunately, his friend, his little buddy is right behind him. And when the gun goes off, some of the National Guardsmen open fire.
Right.
And they chop into pieces. And,
when, and the one kid who was trying to escape makes it.
Right.
And that was, I mean, and that was the irony is that the kid who wanted to stay is the one who ended up getting
killed
by a mistake. Yeah.
And at this point, it all comes crashing down on Timothy Hutton.
Yeah.
I mean, it's real now. I mean,
right.
You got a guy laying there dead.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of anything he did, just because of some stupid accident.
Right. And there's, and this is, I think this is the third great monologue in the movie. And it's Timothy Hutton talking to Sean Penn, and he tells, and he's relating, remembering how it was when he first started, and when he was just a little kid. And he keeps referring to him as a little kid. And he said, you know, we get to the point where, you know, we treat these guys like soldiers. We treat these guys like we are the leaders of men. And he said, they're just little kids. You look at him dead on the concrete, and all you see, and you don't think
is
of
a
him
dead
as,
boy.
Is anything other than what a cool little kid he was. Mm-hmm. And I mean, those are his exact words. And it's heartbreaking because you get to the point where he realizes that this has been a tragic mistake, and he really feels the weight of the leadership.
Now, yeah, it's kind of crashing down on him.
Yeah, he has taken full responsibility for it all along. But there's never really been anything to be responsible for.
Right.
And now there really is.
Now there's real blood on the ground.
Yeah. The one guy getting hurt by the generator accident, that was an accident that was out of our control. That really wasn't our fault. This was so much more.
Well, it's directly related to the entire conflict.
Yes.
Whereas the generator could have happened.
It could have happened. Yeah, it could have happened when there was a power outage and they needed to fire up the generator.
Right.
You know, it could have had nothing to do.
You would look at that situation and say, "Oh, I made a huge mistake." But then, also the fact that you know this is man on man violence,
right?
In this particular situation,
mm-hmm.
which he would think, you know, I would think he would have that,
yeah.
reaction.
Yeah. Know? So, at this, you know, this whole incident happened overnight. And the conversation happens just as dawn is breaking.
Well, yeah, then there's a time clock on the dawn thing because the National Guard colonel said, I'm going to attack at dawn. You've
right.
got till then to make a decision.
Yes.
So the clock's running out on him. They've had a death already. At this point, he's finally realized this can't go on.
Right.
So he starts getting his, like Sean Penn says, just declare victory and let's go home.
Yeah. And yeah, he says, we won. Right. Well, what were we trying to win anyway? Why don't we just declare victory? We can say we were right. We can say we won. Who cares? What does it matter? And I thought that was brilliant. In that,
it's not only brilliant; it's pretty metaphorical
mm-hmm.
for that time. You know, I mean,
declare victory and let's go home. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, we won. Let's leave.
So as he's rounding
GTFO because. Yeah. If we stay, we're going to die. We will lose.
Well, isn't that what they did in Vietnam?
Pretty much.
They declared victory.
Uh-huh.
They declared that there was this peace. We got our peace, and then they left, and then a bunch of people got slaughtered.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it would seem to me that would be, that's pretty.
And depending on how you look at it and the timing of it, they did win. Until they lost.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, you know, well, sustainability.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, as they're, again, rounding up everybody to muster in the front to finally just say, hey, he's calling everybody out, it's over, it's over, it's over, and they're all, sense of relief, from everyone.
Right.
That this madness is going to end now. They no longer have to put on the brave front. So as they're all filing out of the building, unfortunately, there's one person who doesn't get the memo.
Oh, he got the memo. He heard it.
Mm-hmm.
He heard somebody calling, "Stand down. Mm-hmm. We're done. Let's get out of here."
He didn't care.
Not only did he not care, this was retreat. This was surrender. This was loss. And we don't lose. We don't retreat. We don't surrender. Was the mindset that he had. They didn't explicitly say that.
Yes.
Because, I mean, for him, all I saw was that he just started opening fire.
Well, no, he
that's the mindset of that character.
Walks in and tells him, "Hey, it's over." And he looks at him and says, "You know, it's not over." And he's cocking his rifle and starting to take aim.
Yeah, and he takes very long, deliberate aim right at Ronnie Cox's character. And just starts opening fire.
Mm-hmm. And we see the colonel go down, and then the bullets start to fly.
Yeah, everybody on the ground goes down. And the colonel is not dead.
Right,
and
we later find out.
And he's calling for ceasefire. He doesn't want this to happen. He realizes somebody is doing something stupid because everybody's leaving.
Well, yeah, he heard him, you know, calling everybody out. It's over.
When he saw them, they were filing out at the time. They could see it all coming.
Mm-hmm.
And the guard troops figure out where everything's coming from. Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn figure out where it's coming from.
And they're racing back up there.
Yeah, they're running back up there to stop this because they don't want anybody to die at this point. They want this all to be over, and this is not over.
Well, the thing is, it's not only they don't want it to be over, he's spoiling their victory.
Right.
I mean, this is what they were trying to avoid. The actual getting into a firefight diminishes their victory.
Right. We lose if we fight.
Right.
And that's kind of the point they get to. Well, now he's making them lose this fight. He's making them lose their battle.
Mm-hmm.
And they charge up there, and
in one of the best scenes in the whole film, he just looks at them and says, "It's beautiful.
It's beautiful, man."
He's firing away. Yes,
he's got the heavy machine gun out,
and he's just blasting away. And
he gets blasted away.
Well, that it's shit. He's overdosing on testosterone at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's just pumped.
He is fulfilling his destiny as he sees it.
That's right, ladies. Did you hear that? Tom Cruise is overdosing on testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And his face is just that weird smile.
Tom Cruise.
That he's totally high at this point.
It was actually a good piece of acting, considering the character that he was playing throughout the whole movie was that scowling. It was fairly one-dimensional. It was that scowling, morose, you know, win at all odds kind of.
Yeah, I take charge of the situation. You know, damn you all.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a scene earlier in the movie that really establishes his character well. They go out to retrieve supplies before they know they're getting into a lockdown situation. They run out and
pick up the groceries.
They do a grocery run. And the guy even says, you know, "I thought the school was closing." And they're like, "Oh, it's a lot of work closing an institution. We still need supplies to feed the
guys for the next couple of weeks
who are closing stuff down. So we need supplies." So he's like, "Fine." So they take the supplies. One of the two trucks stall. Well, the townies see them.
Well, it happened to stall right in front.
Yeah, right in front of
worst,
like a bar or
right,
something.
Right, yeah, right in the worst possible location.
And they're like, "You're the guys that killed Tommy," or whatever the kid's name was.
Mm-hmm.
And so another altercation is about to break out. Tom Cruise is in the
rear truck.
The rear truck that is still operational jumps out with his M16, starts shooting in the air. Like,
scatter them. Yeah,
he scatters the group. And he's like, "Hey, I acted. I did what I was supposed
to. I defused the situation.
I defused the situation. I won. I won the battle. Mm-hmm. I got our men out
and
of there.
And everybody else is screaming, what the hell are you doing? Yeah. We're not here to shoot up the town."
His mindset, he won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he completed the mission.
Mm-hmm.
He got supplies. Everybody made it home safe.
What more do you need?
Those were my mission parameters. And you know what? It happened.
I fulfilled them.
You know what? We didn't get all the supplies. That was a necessary. You know, I acted on my feet.
Acceptable losses.
It was an acceptable loss. We didn't lose anyone.
Hmm.
And that just shows you the mindset of that character. And he played the part very well, very convincingly. Yeah. So in the end is there's a really nice scene of Sean Penn's character carrying Timothy Hutton's lifeless body out of the building, past the
cadet corps and
the National Guard tank that had busted down the gate to come in, and he's just carrying him off.
Well, he's carrying him off. He's carrying him off like he's the martyr. He's the victim,
mm-hmm.
because he tried to keep it together, and he was killed for it.
Yep. And it was obvious. It was obvious that Tom Cruise's when you watch the scene, it was obvious he was gunned down.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as obvious that Timothy Hutton's character was gunned down, and you don't really know it until you see him walking out of the building with his body.
Well, yeah, because we just see the bullets rip through, and they both fall over.
Right.
And we don't know whether Timothy Hutton was wrestling the Tom Cruise off his firing position, or were they hit by the bullets from the tank's machine guns?
Yeah. Yeah. So that pretty much wraps the movie.
Well, there's one final scene in here which is kind of telling. Before they roll the closing credits, it cuts back to the parade ground scene.
Oh,
where
yes.
They're all marching in review.
That's true.
And I think it was, the director's final way of saying they're thinking back to a more pleasant time when things were all, where things were going great, the flags were flying, the bands were playing, we were marching, we were proud. They were proud of us.
Right.
We were at our best.
Yeah.
And that's how we want to be remembered, not as a bunch of terrorists.
Right. But at the same time, watching that scene, you can see the seeds of what was there in the pride, in the stoicism of Tom Cruise's character. He had that same scowl on his face. He was marching, but he was marching for a purpose,
mm-hmm.
where there were other guys that were doing it, and you could see they were doing it, and they were very proud of the situation they were in. For him, it wasn't pride; it was the mission.
Mm-hmm.
You could even see that look on his face as this scene was playing out, and it was kind of cool because it was a reminder that everything that happened really was. At the same time, I think it was also a callback to it really wasn't the fault of these kids. Because the parade, the session of the parade, they all look back to George C. Scott, and it always comes back to him.
Mm-hmm.
It all flows back to him. Well, he is the one responsible.
He's
ultimately
the father figure that they're all looking up to.
Right, right. And ultimately, he is the one that is responsible for the whole thing.
Yes, final comment here in the chat room. A cadet with sunglasses. Yes, if you notice in the first marching, he wasn't wearing them, and in the second marching, he was.
Yeah.
A little continuity error there. Yes, it would probably not have been allowed, but it was probably a sunny day there, and he just forgot to take them off.
Yeah. Yeah. All in all, I really like the movie. I really do. And what I like the most about it was it kind of opened up, you know, from my side, from the side of growing up in a military lifestyle.
Just say it. You were a military brat.
I was. I was an Air Force brat.
Mm-hmm.
I make no bones about that.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was in the Air Force. And I grew up on Air Force bases. Grew up around it. I grew up where most of our prejudice was between enlisted and officers,
mm-hmm.
which is something, you know.
It's a whole other thing in itself.
It's a completely different lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were times where I remember hearing stories of, especially when we were here, there were places that my dad would go to, like they'd go to a bar, you know, for somebody's retirement ceremony or something like that. And a couple weeks later, a bar or a restaurant or something would be blacklisted. No military person is allowed to go into that bar. And the reason being is because either the patrons or the bar owner or somebody did something to negatively impact
someone
in the military.
To get them all thrown out, or at least to get them not to ask back.
Yeah.
She's used different symbolism.
All right.
Elaborate.
Go ahead. I'm just going to keep talking. So,
what's a different symbol?
While you're typing, I'm going to go ahead and keep talking from my perspective. So I mean, I could see that, and I could see it from the military side, where a lot of other people might see it from the civilian side and see, you know, those kids, those reckless, out of control kids who are being taught with live weapons and being put in a situation they should have never been in, and things like that.
Well, they just see them as brainwashed kids,
right? And they were. And what I loved about it was then Ronnie Cox's character, who comes in and really is the voice of reason, is the one who is the character that I can relate to, because that was like, you know, that everybody I knew.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the guy that I knew, you know, in the people that my dad worked with, my father, you know, those kind of folks. That was what it was.
Well, again, this is a story of, again, true believers. We have Timothy Hutton. He mm-hmm. is a true believer.
Right.
He eats this stuff. He lives this stuff every day. He doesn't know anything different.
Yeah.
The others are not so true believers. I mean, he really idolizes General Baish a lot, almost to the point of just blind hero worship.
Sure.
Timmy the Hutt does?
Yeah, yeah. Timmy the Hutt.
But see, and that's why he was the cadet in charge. He was the true believer. Therefore, he was that person. It kind of, and this is going to be a stretch, it kind of relates back to, and this is where I'm going to pull you into the conversation a little more, in looking at, like, religion. You know, people, you know, one of the great questions in religion is why was, you know, if you're a believer, why was Mary chosen to be the bearer of Christ? Why was she chosen to be that person? Well, because she was the believer. She was the one. You know, it had nothing to do... She wasn't chosen at random.
There was a
purpose. She believed without a doubt it was in her to be that person. And it's not just some...
Random act.
Timothy Hutton wasn't just picked out of a lineup. And it's not just because he won the competition. He won the competition because he believed so fervently. He followed the rules. He knew all the rules. He believed and lived that, and for him, that was what he aspired to. Yeah, that was it. That's all there was.
And then he finds out his God has clay feet, or is all too human. He had the audacity to go die on them,
right,
and leave them without any direction.
Yeah.
What do you think about Kate's?
Okay, now comments? for the audience, I'm going to read what Kate says. As a mom, I see lost boys. From the general on down. The general, all he has ever knew was dissipating before him. The Timothy Hutton, Sean Penn, Tom Cruise, their characters were given a quote-unquote life through the general. Timothy Hutton was groomed for his, quote, position. I agree with all of that to the point with Timothy Hutton. He was groomed to his position, but he had the belief in that position and in that lifestyle. And unless someone had the belief, they couldn't be groomed for that position. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you had to have both.
Disciples, yes. Yeah. You had to have willing disciples there.
Right. And if you have a willing disciple, then you can groom them for the position. You can't just pick someone at random and say, you are going to be the chosen one.
Right.
There has to be a core there, something about him that made him more susceptible to the belief. So, I don't know where else.
That's
I was
right.
Going to go with that.
Well, we don't really. It's been a long time since we've read somebody's full comments or mm-hmm. or responses or anything on an episode.
He was indoctrinated. He was brought into it because it was all he had. You know, in a way, it was interesting that they related through Ronnie Cox's character. He was relating that the governor only saw these kids as terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, if you look at how terrorist organizations train the young,
they
recruit them young, they train them in the lifestyle, they strip away
the
outside world, the individualism, they show them how the outside world doesn't believe in them, that if you
it's us
live
versus
this
them.
Lifestyle, you will be rewarded by your acts. And that it's kind of interesting that they use that, because it does kind of follow through.
And they always use the "you're different from everyone else" argument.
Right.
You know, there was a thing of talking about how they recruit, you know, Palestinians for the Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
They were talking about this, and they were basically saying, well, they get them at around the age where, you know, they feel they're going largely through the issues that all teenagers go through. You know, they feel different. They feel, you know, and they get them at that age. And
yeah.
Like, when they're vulnerable.
Belong to something. Yeah.
You get the very vulnerable age, and you fill their head with a bunch of nonsense. And, of course, they're yours.
Right, right.
But let's not be so smug. We also do that too. We just do it in a slightly different way.
Sure. I was only saying that with respect to the actual mm-hmm. report of what it was. Mm-hmm. I think one thing.
What's interesting, if you look at this is a theme that's not just related to this. If you look at Star Wars and the way they train the Jedi, that's kind of the same MO they took with the Jedi. Get them before they're socially trained, before they've had those attachments beyond parental attachments. Get them to a point where we can guide their growth, through puberty and their teenage years.
But I would argue in this country it's not quite like that. Because, well, one, there's no draft, you know.
Right.
And two, people have a lot of options in our free society. I mean, there are probably some people that are groomed from birth to do a certain way of life, and these people in this TAPS movie were that. But I would not say that, at large, a majority of young people feel that they have no choices, and then someone offers them, you know, a glass of dirty water, as opposed to no water, and say, drink this, and then they say, okay. And that's not the way this country works.
Right.
I mean, some people probably go through that experience, but that's not.
No, but that's I not mean, how this country I works. Mean, in the 80s, you know, one of the things that was kind of the thing that we had to be made aware of was that, you know, those kids who are the outsiders, those ones who are smart but different, those are the ones that the Russians could get. The Soviets will indoctrinate them because, you know what? You're different. Nobody understands the way you think. We understand how you think.
Right.
And that was, I mean, that was a fear that we were led to believe that was going to happen. If you're not careful, you know, you have to be on the lookout because the Russians could get you.
There's one under every bed and closet. All societies, to some degree, do that.
Well, I mean, that's the purpose of society,
right.
is to self-sustain. If you don't sustain yourself, it's just going to break down in anarchy and chaos.
Once you're in a, I mean,
yes, but it's the intent. Yeah, but it's the intent. In other words, yes, you do need some of that to maintain a civilization.
Right.
But when you take that and turn it inward on itself, and you create your own little cult,
mm-hmm.
Then it gets kind of dangerous, either for the participants or for the society in general.
Right. And this was an extreme example. The movie TAPS represents an extreme example of one guy who was deluded, who believed what he believed.
I wouldn't say he's deluded. He's a true believer. He really believes in this institution, and he wants to save it.
He does.
But he doesn't see any other way to do it. He's only been trained in one mode of operation.
But he has also been
put up a response.
But it's also he has also obviously been given autonomy. Because the board of directors doesn't really understand what's going on there.
Well, they never even talk to him. I mean, they just push him off the side. Go away, kid. You're bothering us.
Right. But that also shows you that for years, he's operated in the dark. Nobody's known exactly what he was doing there. He probably hasn't had any checks and balances to work against because the board of directors, all they care about is the bottom line.
Well, the only person he ever had any contact with was General Bache anyway.
Right.
And the thing is, though, when there's one scene where he comes back from the meeting with the board of directors and he drops his briefcase, takes off his coat, and sits down at his desk and looked like, you know, like, oh my God, everything I worked for just ended.
Right.
And he doesn't confide in any of even the cadets. He could have brought them in and that night and said, hey, guys, unfortunately, this is what's going to happen. He just drops it on them on the parade ground at their crowning achievement. I mean, he just, like, all their world just turns to ashes at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have a whole lot to add to this. I think the movie does create a lot of interesting discussion.
Oh yeah.
And this is the kind of movie that I think it would be kind of cool to see if we have any more follow-up discussion, like in the chat room or in the comments and such after the fact, because I think your experience and when you were raised could influence how exactly you see this movie.
And that I think that's what the whole purpose of it is. It's this movie allows a lot of interpretation.
It does.
And over time it really adds to the discussion because we've now got 20 years of history now between
almost
us.
Almost
30. 30, yep. 30 years of history and perspective, and plus it's also relevant even to today's issues.
Right.
But see, that, I mean, that sounds like a movie that does the job of being, you know, well-written and sparking, you know, conversation.
Sure.
Today's movies, today's supposed, you know, films about the conflict don't even scratch the surface.
Well, no, they're
agenda films. They're all...
Right.
Well, they were, this is a very rare type of movie. It didn't do commercially very well.
Yeah.
Mainly because of maybe the time or the subject matter. But it has aged really well. You can watch it today, and it's still just as relevant as it was back then. Probably even more so.
Yeah, and what I think what really gives it its legs is the fact that if this movie has an agenda, it probably has about three different agendas, depending on how you look at it.
Well, that's again, right. that may have been intentional.
Sure.
And to be a little vague in order to let the audience make the decision of the rightness or wrongness.
Right. And I think, you know what, I think this movie actually plays well and in a different period and a different type of story, but again with the military and again with Tom Cruise to a movie we've talked about before, A Few Good Men. It's got that same, you know, an incident that could be looked at in a couple of different ways. You have people that, depending on how you watch the movie and what you believe and what you see in it, you know, were they wrong in doing what they did? Were they right in doing what they did? Were they right based on the information they had, how they were trained? You know, and again, you get to you. It all comes down to a leader who did things the way he did things and with the belief that what he was doing was absolutely right. Whether it was or not, that was the belief that he held. And the world that he created around him believed it or be damned, period. You had to believe it was his way or you weren't part of the world.
Do you see the general as a tragic figure?
I think the general could have been a tragic figure given more story.
Right, we don't see him,
but you don't,
on screen long enough to really get a sense of his life.
I would think the general would be a tragic figure had he not died in the hospital.
Right,
if they could come back to the general and show us what he was going through watching this from the outside, unable to do anything about it, unable to communicate he was ultimately the one who had power to shut this whole thing down.
Yeah. Right. Just one word.
And he died.
That's probably why they had to kill him for the purposes of the
right
plot.
That's just it. You wanted to create more confusion for the main character. I mean, he no longer has his moral compass is now completely gone.
Yeah.
He has to make all the decisions he's going to make from this part have to be his own. There's no higher authority he can quote to.
Right.
So the weight of the command falls very heavy on his shoulders.
Yeah. And I think the general could have been a tragic figure, but it's really just hard given what we were given about him. It's hard to say that he was a tragic figure. And if this was, I mean, and I just don't know, if this was a novel, I think they could have come back to the general and given more story about the general without influencing the plot, this other plot, and made the general a tragic figure. And I think you can probably extrapolate that there was a certain amount of tragedy involved in it because he was obviously a great leader of men at one point who is now relegated to headmaster of a military school.
Yeah, actually, this movie is based on a novel. It's called Father Sky.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I might have to check that one out.
Right. It goes.
I'm not familiar with it.
It's the same basic plot, but there's a lot more character development in it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you can see that they kind of had to lose some of the character for the movie. And considering this movie was made in 1981, it was over 2 hours long.
Right.
That's
a long time. That was a long movie.
Yeah, that was a long movie in 1981.
Yeah, if the general had lived, would he have led the revolt? I don't think so.
I don't think so. I think the general would have shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
I think where the general.
Well, he'd already accepted the fact that the school was closing.
He accepted the fact that the school was closing, and where the general really becomes a tragic character is when his gun accidentally goes off.
Right.
And I think at that moment, until you see him getting led away and being driven off in the police car, that is his great moment of tragedy. That was something that he...
Right, I'm going down to being the leader of men to being charged as a common criminal.
Right.
Well, I don't,
and he didn't fight it, though. He knew that he made a mistake. He knew his gun should not have been loaded,
but if you watch the movie carefully, it's not him who draws the piece
right.
out.
He doesn't.
It's one of the kids who pulls the gun out of his holster, and he's got his hand wrapped around
it. Oh, yeah. Him. Yeah, he's not the one that fired the weapon, but he never did anything...
to make sure that it was unloaded.
Well, he also did not say it wasn't his fault.
Mm-hmm.
He took complete responsibility for it.
Yeah,
and I think that's an interesting point, too, is that it was very clear that somebody else took the gun and fired it, but he never said, it wasn't my fault, I didn't do it. And he could have. They could have done powder tests, and somebody would have had powder on their hands from making the shot. It could have been a known quantity that he wasn't the one who did it.
I haven't seen that part of the movie, obviously, but
right.
I think there's a difference between the Jack Nicholson character in A Few Good Men and this guy, because the Jack Nicholson character in A Few Good Men might have led a revolt because he was very utilitarian.
Yes.
And it didn't matter if one of our own died, if it was for the greater cause of Guantanamo Bay.
Right.
But I don't get the impression from what you guys are saying that it's the same character in this movie, because...
No.
And I'm not saying it's the same character, but it's the same idea of the leader who built the world around him.
Right. But that world is aimed at enemies that he perceives as always... Basically, you always are vigilant because there are always enemies.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you take out your own,
mm-hmm.
you know, unnecessarily, or you would go against the National Guard or the town or anything like that. Whereas the general in... Or is he a general in... He's a
yeah.
colonel. In
he's a colonel.
A few good men.
Yeah.
He's a true... I mean, he's like Denzel Washington Training Day, where at some point it doesn't matter what is what anymore, because the whole point... is just to preserve
the status quo.
He is,
status
yeah.
quo. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
my job is to be the boogeyman.
Even though George C. Scott's character is flawed, he's not a
he's
bad
not that. No, no. I think George C. Scott's problem is that he doesn't see himself as
catalyst.
No, I think he is ultimately part of the problem, because he also sees these kids as kids playing at soldier.
Well, no, I get a different take.
But
he didn't see them as playing soldier. He sees them as, not as kids, but he sees them as miniaturized adults. He doesn't realize just how much influence he's got over these guys' lives.
I think we're saying the same thing, but in a different way. I think we are saying the same thing. He doesn't see that these kids are taking it as seriously as they are. Yeah, I agree with that. I do agree with that.
He's blind to that aspect of it himself.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
All right.
And Kate's got a couple more comments. The one she asked, I think if the general lived, he would have led the revolt. We talked about that a little bit earlier. Perhaps George C. Scott's general role died as a heartbroken military has-been. He indoctrinated them well and failed to recognize his influence. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of one thing that when Timothy Hutton's father... figure shows up to
yes.
the parents' education. He starts running the general down as to that he's not the genius you think he is.
Right.
That he was a broken down man who was transferred here because he was at the end of his career and he was incompetent. And that's when
it's starting to sound like the plot of Sergeant Bilko.
Well, yeah. And that's when the Timothy Hutton character really starts to take this personally. From his own father, you don't know what he's about. You're just repeating what, rumors you've heard.
Right.
And this sets up the tension between them.
Yes. Yes.
Not that there wasn't a lot of tension to start with.
When my heroes were all rock stars when I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you would think they were these great, great, great people, and then you would read something about them that totally snapped your idea of what they were.
But you still defended them.
But and you would push that aside.
People don't understand the genius that it takes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is hard work.
Yeah, exactly.
So what if he only uses looped in soundtracks?
What if
he only knows one chord? It's a genius chord.
Look at the genius that has been placed on somebody like Kurt Cobain,
right?
Who was basically an artistic heroin addict who couldn't handle the pressure of fame. Period. That's all he was.
He was a good lyricist and stuff, but I mean...
He was an artistic heroin addict, though.
Yes. Well, he was a heroin addict who was an artist, let's put it this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was both.
Yeah. I mean, and he painted his brains on a wall. And left, you know, left a child without a father.
Such an artist as me dies.
but at the same time, look at the generation of people who defend him and his work and have thrust him.
What's the line from the Fly? It was around that time too. The U2 song. He says, "Every artist is a cannibal. Every poet is a thief. I'll kill their inspiration and then sing about their grief."
Oh,
which that reminds me of that. You know,
there's a line from a military from a Marillion song that's the fire in your belly that gave you the song, and suddenly it went wrong, they call you a genius because you're easy to sell.
Nice.
You know, and it has nothing to.
There's a lot with that too.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with.
Say the part about the fly, the song from the song The Fly. Is that what she wants to know?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Probably.
Every artist is a cannibal. Every poet is a thief. All kill their inspiration and then sing about their grief. That's a Bono lyric.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
it is brilliant.
It's a great album.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, you've got a heavy dose of hero worship going on here.
Yeah.
In Timothy Hutton's character.
Yeah.
Again, very well written script. I mean, this is a ridiculously well written piece of work because all of those characters' motivations were very true to the people they were, the life that they had. All the characters were ridiculously well thought
out. Which you don't get. I guess I've seen quite a few of these recent films about military life or this thing, and they all seem like pre-written characters that don't actually interact with each other. They seem like they have absolutely no...
A bunch of loose skits all tied together with a very thin plot line.
Yeah,
and it's because someone decided, oh, I want a character who represents what I think about this. And then I want a character who represents their antagonist. And they're writing this up, but it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't really get at the heart of real
issues.
I have
two characters, now I need dialogue.
Right.
And I tell you, as goofy as parts of the movie 300 were...
I didn't see that one.
Just for the incredible silliness.
Okay.
And there is some incredible silliness in the movie. One of the things that I really like about it, though... is the relationship between Leonidas and his wife. I know a lot of people in the military. One of the things that bugs me greatly about the media is how they show, and it's almost become the stereotype, is that when the husband goes off to war, the wife completely breaks down and can't do anything and can't function and fights it and tries to keep him from running off. And that's not always the way it is. That does happen. But that's not always the way it is, and those characters in 300. You got something to say? That's fine. I'll let you go. The characters in 300. You know, he's like, we have to go, and she says, yes, you do.
Yeah.
You know, and that's that.
I support you.
Yeah, she supported him. She was the rock at home, which he needed. You need to know that everything is going to be okay at home when you go off to do this. And that's something that sometimes is overlooked.
It's become a cliche that works for the way they want to portray...
a cheap emotional drama.
Exactly.
Yep.
And in reality, I mean, historically, up until maybe just the last 30 years, and the way women were always portrayed, as I understood it, were they were involved. I mean, they were... It was, you know... What's the lady with the mechanic?
Rosie the Riveter. Yeah.
All, I mean, they were a part of the deal. It wasn't
you had
just
to be.
Stay at home and weep all day kind of deal.
It's still that way. It's still that you have to be. You have to be fully invested in
You've
it.
You've got kids to raise. Uh-huh. You've got a career
Life goes
yourself,
on.
Probably. I mean, you're still contributing to, you know.
Kate's got a couple of comments. The strongest women I know are wives of career soldiers / military. Real military wives do not have time for cheap emotional drama. And you know what? One of the cool things is being raised in the military and having gone to retirement ceremonies when my dad retired. When my father retired from the Air Force, they celebrated my dad's career and they celebrated my mother for being his wife.
Yes.
And being there for him when he, I mean, now granted, my dad did not serve in any kind of combat situations, but he did have times where he never really did any extended tours away from the family. When he did most of his overseas stuff, he did it. I mean, he met my mom in Okinawa. They, you know, my mom was, her dad was in the military, and that's how they met there. So we didn't have a lot of that common experience of dad having to be gone for 6 months.
Right.
We were fortunate in that. But at the same time, the military really does appreciate the role of the spouse in that, and they recognize it and celebrate it as part of the retirement ceremony.
And I think it's important that you say spouse too, because the military is there's so many more women in the military.
Oh yeah,
now.
The face of the military has changed completely.
Yes, you know, where the spouse is sometimes the guy at home.
Exactly.
And Courage Under Fire was a good movie. I mean, there's a few cheesy moments, but it was a good movie to demonstrate how the military had changed in that regard.
Right.
And that's another thing that I think the movies of this particular era completely ignore. Like, it doesn't even matter, you know.
Well, so, again, the cheap emotional drama sells tickets.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Especially on Lifetime Network.
I don't think we can top that insight.
I don't think we can.
Just the last thing I was trying to say there. There's a nice little scene in the movie Apollo 13, where they're all the families fretting about telling the mother of one of the astronauts that they're in trouble, and so they finally break down. And it's one television reporter who asks, "Ma'am, how do you feel about your son's spaceship being damaged?" And she says, "Son, if washing machines could fly, my son would do it."
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's not worried one dang bit.
She knows the person. And that's what's important. Let's see. We're being told we're talking too fast.
Well, that's not
new. And yeah, no, it's really not. Kate has another comment. "I have an award certificate from the men that worked under my husband when he was in Kuwait. They told him a dozen times, 'You are so lucky.'" She says she has it right next to her master's degree. That's awesome.
That is awesome.
It's very cool. Yeah. All right.
It's probably time to wrap it up.
Yeah, I think probably so. I think all in all, this film is a good film. It's worth watching. It has aged ridiculously well. You get to see some outstandingly talented
young actors right at the beginning of their careers.
At the very beginning of their careers. And you can kind of get a glimpse of what was to come from them.
Yes, and the fun thing is, if you watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you will see Sean Penn turn 180 degrees in a character.
Yeah, and watching those two movies back to back, you can see, you can understand how he became the phenomenal actor he is. Because most people only, they think of his first movie as Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And forget he was in Taps.
And yeah, everybody thinks of him first as Spicoli.
Because that's, again, the one that made him a name.
Well, it was commercially more successful.
Right.
We want to thank Kate for commenting contributing significantly. I can't talk.
Yes, and our ultimate.
Yeah, our fourth host tonight, our fourth host tonight since Adam decided not to join us this evening.
Yes, and our 12 guests who've stuck with us all through.
Yes.
Hopefully you'll come back next week.
Yes, next week we're going to be discussing the new Harry Potter movie, Harry Potter and the
one more
movie so we can make a lot more money.
Harry Potter and the Search for More Money.
Yes.
No, that's the last.
That's film. The eighth. That's the eighth movie because there were only seven books, but they're making eight movies. This is not a lie, but that's mostly because the seventh book is so dense.
Well, yes, you're trying to condense one of the most pivotal books down to a 2-hour movie.
Well,
and keep it interesting.
And honestly, and I'm not going to ruin anything for anybody who may not have read it and still wants to. The seventh book has very little character development. It is all plot, and it is all trying
backstory.
To wrap up. It's backstory that needs to be told to wrap up everything that has been established in the six previous books. And there's a lot that's been established in six previous books. Wow. And there's a lot that hasn't appeared in the movies.
Oh, yeah.
Because they've just cut. They've liberally cut a lot of the story.
Otherwise, each one of the movies would be 5 hours long.
Right.
Even though...
They've liberally cut from the books. The first book-to-movie translation was very true book-to-movie. After that, they start getting farther and farther apart.
Well, that's because J.K. Rowling kept writing them thicker and thicker.
Yeah, that too.
I mean, she had so many little subplots rolling off to one side of the other, which makes... Which makes sense later on, but it was kind of obtuse at the time.
Right, right.
I'm just going to say, I'm going to go see this, but as much as I liked the last one, that was actually a good one, I was burned, I thought. I wasted my 2 hours of my precious time on the first three or whatever, four or whatever that I've seen. So
the first, you know what?
I expect to not be impressed. The first three books,
and by extrapolation, the first three movies are not fantastic.
Yeah,
when you get to about the fourth book, it starts getting better. In the series, the sixth book is probably the most mature read, and not to say that it's difficult content
through all 800 pages.
Yeah, it's a dense book. Jeez. but it's a ton of backstory. It's a good mystery. The book, not the movie. We're talking two different things. Well, the book has a considerably different tone than the sixth movie.
It suddenly gets a lot darker.
Yeah, well, the movie to book translation is very different,
right? Because they're just concentrating on the highlights. They're taking the big plot elements,
right,
and not leaving out all the little subtle undertones of what comes next,
right, right.
But that's the type of medium you deal with.
Well, and we're talking and way too much. Yeah, we're talking way too much about the movie. We'll talk about it next week.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So Robert, next week,
welcome back, Carter. And we are out. All right, we're going to
see you. No, we can't. That's fine.
All right.
See ya.
Bye.